two at the time, that there was a contingency agreement. It was in place when he took over.
Okay. This is a related question. Is there any indication in the record whether the decision to try to get Sumner as a witness was the client's or the lawyer's?
It was the client's, I believe.
Okay. And the contingency was fully disclosed to the court?
It was, Your Honor. And I back up. It was the client's, I believe. The client is the one who gave him the contingency. I don't know whose decision it was that he was going to testify.
That isn't in the record?
That is not in the record.
Okay. Thank you.
Although the cases are not totally extensive on excluding witnesses who have a contingent fee, the cases that have ruled on it say the best remedy for doing so is to exclude the witness as from testifying. And we have cited a number of cases that say that it's abhorrent to our system of justice to have a witness testify who has a contingent fee interest in the case. And the one that this probably discusses it the most was the NLRB case. I understand it was in the dissent, but it also covered the reasons for it. Also, in U.S. versus Singular, those reasons were also discussed in the dissent. And the reason was that was a case where the government was accused of buying testimony by human plea bargains. And the majority just said, no, that's fine, because that comes under the statute, a separate statute. The dissent went on and described in detail the reasons for not allowing witnesses who have an interest in the lawsuit, a contingent interest in the lawsuit, or have an interest in the lawsuit from testifying.
Were we to adopt a per se rule to that effect, wouldn't there be some tension with rules with CRE 601, which seems to indicate that everybody can testify?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because all the cases, if you look in our reply, all the cases that we cited were adopted after 601. In the cases, and after the federal rules, which had 601.
Okay.
So I believe it wouldn't, Your Honor. So that is the first problem we had with Mr. Sumner testifying. The second problem, and probably the most devastating problem, was that Mr. Sumner had no personal information whatsoever of the facts. He did not become involved in the case until after all the facts were concluded. That's undisputed. Plaintiff proffered Mr. Sumner as somebody to come in and testify as to all these documents that were in the record and to summarize, quote, these documents. For a day and a half, Mr. Sumner was on that stand testifying as to each and every document and offering his opinion as to what that document meant and what the significance was.
But an expert witness can give opinions on facts that he doesn't know, but my understanding from what you said was the judge precluded him from testifying as an expert. But you were saying he testified as an expert witness.
Well,
now,
it was a little difficult to determine, Your Honor. I mean, well, you're right.
Let me give you an example.
Sure.
He was listed as an expert witness in the plaintiff's disclosures on the question of the value of the Epic deal.
Correct.
Did he testify on the value of the Epic deal?
Sort of, over my objection. He came in and testified as to the value. He testified how to calculate damages over my objection.
Sort of. I'm sure it's sort of. Okay. So if he testified, and you objected because the judge had ruled that he couldn't testify as an expert, and you're saying he was nonetheless allowed to give an expert opinion.
That is correct. In
that regard, did you specifically object under Rule 701, which you argued in your brief?
Yes, that was my whole basis of...
Was that in the in limine motion that you raised 701?
Your Honor, it was the first 3 days of trial, I think, until finally the judge just gave me a standing objection.
Including 701.
701, 602.
So during the first part of the trial, you made specific objections based on 701.
Your Honor, I don't recall whether I specifically mentioned 701, but I mentioned 602, which is the premise for it, which he had no personal knowledge. Therefore, you couldn't have a perception of what the facts were to give an opinion.
Okay.
In any case, there's no Colorado cases that allow these summary witnesses. especially on underlying facts. There were no cases whatsoever on that. I think we've cited all, the only cases are federal court cases that address issues in which there were drug cases, conspiracy cases, or tax cases, and they all warn that this is the exception, not the rule, and there's a danger in allowing this. Otherwise, you just allow somebody to come in. If you had somebody who was an MBA and had sat on a number of boards, you could have him come in and summarize documents and testify as to what those documents meant and what happened in the case. And the problem with that is you add the credibility of this witness to the plaintiff's case, even though we had no information about the facts itself.
Isn't that a discretionary ruling?
Your Honor, I don't think it's discretionary when in fact, there's no rule that allows the witness to come in and summarize facts. And that was in U.S. versus, I believe, Naranja held that.
Well, don't we either have to review that ruling for an abuse of discretion or adopt a per se rule that says you can never have a summary witness who lacks personal knowledge of the facts?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know whether you do or not, because under the 4E470 case, it's kind of a mixed question because he admitted that he had no information. So if somebody admits they have no firsthand information of the facts and then the court allows them to testify, isn't that a question of law there, whether he should be allowed to testify? Because he has no information, no personal firsthand knowledge.
Okay, but isn't that the equivalent of us adopting, and I'm not rejecting, but right. Wouldn't that be the equivalent of adopting a per se rule that says, you know, the so-called summary witness can never testify?
I believe that's probably the best way to go, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you.
Also, Exhibits 101, Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 101 were admitted into evidence. And here's what exactly happened. Mr. Sumner, all the documents were admitted into evidence. Mr. Sumner got up and testified for a day and a half as to what those exhibits said. And he used a chart, Exhibit 1, which had bolding on it, and summarized all these documents. That was also admitted into evidence. Then Mr. Mahoney got up and replicated exactly, talked about the same events that Mr. Sumner did. And he put in Exhibit 101, which was a shorter version in color, stating what Mr. Mahoney knew, what Mr. Mahoney didn't know. And we raised an issue on the exhibits themselves that they're pedagogical rather than should be 10,006 exhibits. And the court, because of an error of law interpreting Irving, allowed them in. There was no instruction given that they were not evidence because they did go into evidence. And they should never come into evidence. It's all cumulative to start with. And it's not harmless because, as I say, it was a 5-day trial of which 1.5 days was Mr. Sumner.
You say that there was no instruction.
Well, there would have been no instruction. I'm sorry, there would have been no instruction. What should have happened is they shouldn't have been allowed into evidence, and there should have been an instruction saying they weren't allowed into evidence because they weren't evidence.
Did you ask for such an instruction?
Well, they didn't go into they went into evidence, so the instruction would have been meaningless, Your Honor, would have contradicted what the court did. Both on, and then actually on the fraud and the economic loss doctrine, we believe that they failed to prove the fraud case because they knew exactly what the situation was. And with respect to the economic loss doctrine, we believe that these duties all arose out of the contract, and as such, they are subject to the contract. Now, the court has raised the issue about whether that's been preserved, and all I can tell the court, if the court finds that it hasn't, I would request that the court exercise its discretion and rule on that if the error was, it was mine, not the client's, it wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't a decision made for strategic advantage. There was no advantage to it. It was simply an oversight. And we would request that under those circumstances that the court, since it's been fully briefed and the trial court has ruled on already, exercise its discretion. And I will reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, I'm ready. Gentlemen of the panel, may it please the court. My name is Francis Vincent Cristiano. My registration number is 7578. And I'm here appearing on behalf of the appellee and plaintiff just in case. I think I'll start with an overview of this case so that you get an understanding of what sort of the dynamics of the case were, and then move into what Mr. McGowan has addressed and you've responded to in terms of the law. This was sort of what I describe as a very sort of modern, sort of evolving case where the allegations were fraud, concealment, lack of disclosure, and then out-and-out misrepresentation. The proof was based upon an extensive, huge amount of emails that were exchanged, mostly with the defendants and this potential suitor that they had, Epic Resources, who ultimately bought their business, a business that was clearly within the intent of the commission agreement that my client, Mr. Mahoney, and his company had. It was based upon that, and it was based upon a recording of his final, sort of the closing conversation he had with Mr. Murray, where Mr. Murray really filled the role of, as we all refer to, kind of the closer, somebody who's similar to Raphael Bettencourt, and you can set it up, and you got to have the closer, and Mr. Murray was the closer. But he was also a major participant from the beginning when the other individual, Mr. Rinesmith, contacted Epic and decided that he was going to keep it secret from Mr. Mahoney. Mr. Murray was entirely in on this and supported it all the way through to the end, where he presented him with this termination agreement that he signed because he had been fraudulently induced into signing it. The only way we could prove this is through the emails. We could not use, really practically, I think as you all three of you gentlemen fully understand, the testimony of the defendants who controlled all of the facts on their side. They were not in any way cooperative witnesses. We used one of them, Mona, I forgot her last name, but she was the one who established sort of the critical facts which rebutted their contention that this was all sort of a properly approved corporate action to have Mr. Mahoney sign this thing. Instead, her testimony was it wasn't that. It was Mr. Murray and Mr. Rinesmith meeting privately and deciding that they were going to get and induce Mr. Mahoney into signing this termination agreement, whereby he would waive a 5% commission to what they knew to be a $34 million sale, and didn't want to disclose anything to that. And then at the end, Mr. Murray out and out directly misrepresented a number of facts to do that. So it has to do with how you prove that. And there is this sort of evolving concept in the law, which we were dealing with, and we didn't particularly understand all its nuances, but we were dealing with it, and we were getting feedback from Mr. McGloin during the trial as to what the federal cases were, and we were following the federal cases in terms of its guidance. So I do think this is a significant case if you want to address this issue, which is the issue of the summary witness and the issue of summary exhibits. In the issue of pedagogic exhibits, it's very significant, I think, and will become more and more significant as we go on in this complex world of ours where we can prove things through email. Very, very reliable facts. And I will say this, that what happened here, you know, he said that Mr. Sumner, who's with us today, fine gentleman, very, very, very outstanding gentleman, very intelligent individual, was there for a day and a half because he cross-examined him plenty. And every time there was an email, if Mr. Sumner, he thought Mr. Sumner had interpreted it wrong, he'd say, well, this email says this, or this email says this, or this email says that. Did you consider this? Did you consider that?
Let's step back if we could.
Go ahead.
There's a threshold question here of listing and calling a witness who's on a contingency. Why isn't that a violation of Rule 3.4 on its face?
I understand this. And okay, and he brought it up, and he's been waiving this term contingency unendingly in this case. We categorically, emphatically reject the notion that Mr. Sumner was a contingent fee witness. Absolutely 100% rejected.
How?
And I don't, okay. A contingent fee witness or a contingent fee lawyer is somebody by definition who doesn't have any interest in the subject matter. Mr. Sumner, and by the way, this came to me without my involvement whatsoever. I think Mr. Mahoney would be the first person to admit this. Mr. Mahoney had this problem. First of all, he was broke, he didn't get any money, he needed support. But most of all, he was a childhood rape victim, and he felt like he'd been raped again by what had happened here, and he needed Mr. Sumner's support. So he said, they signed a contract, and it said, you will have a piece of this chosen action. Mr. Sumner was the owner of the chosen action, called the claim. He had a 10% interest in the chosen action. He had a direct interest that he could execute on, do whatever he wanted to do with regard to that. He was not being paid for his testimony. He was being paid for his support of the claim, and he was granted an interest in consideration of it.
Okay, but at the time you listed him as a witness, and the in limine motions were argued, and he testified, he stood to gain 10% of approximately $2 million claim only if the claim succeeded, correct?
If his value in the chosen action is, another way of saying it, I agree with you, okay? But the other way of saying it is, if the chosen action is valueless, he doesn't have an interest that's worth anything.
And doesn't that create huge credibility issues in terms of how he's going to testify?
Okay, let me compare it to something else that I'm familiar with, because I do a lot of this. Doctors testify on their own behalf, okay, in medical negligence cases.
You mean the defendant doctor?
What?
The defendant doctor.
Absolutely, okay. Do you have an interest in this? Absolutely. What's the interest in this? I'm defending against a claim. I don't want to pay this claim. I don't think it's right that I have to pay.
Every litigant has an interest in the outcome of the case. We're not talking about a litigant here. We are talking about a person who you knew had a contingent fee arrangement and who you listed both as an expert witness and a fact witness, knowing that he had a contingent fee arrangement. I don't think you're answering Judge Webb's question. How could that not be a violation of Rule 3.4? The judge clearly found, insofar as he was offered as an expert, it was a violation of 3.4. If he did testify as an expert, 3.4 was violated. How could it not be a violation of 3.4?
Okay, I reject the premise, with all due respect, but very strongly, I reject the premise. Your question and your confrontation with me is based upon the notion that he had a contingent fee, and I absolutely reject that. Your contention, and the other premise you have, number two you have, is that there was some sort of ruling where the trial judge did rule that he was a contingent fee witness. The judge, Judge Pratt, excellent judge, decided that he could not testify as an expert, but he could testify as a layperson. Therefore, the bounds of what he was going to testify to were going to be guided by 701 and not by 702. You made the point as well, Your Honor. Very well, I thought. That he was listed not as an expert with regard to anything other than the value of the underlying business. He was rejected as an expert with regard to that issue by the trial court judge, and he did not testify with regard to valuation. He did not testify with regard to opinions. And if you want to get into pedagogic witnesses, which I think is a great way to go here, and before I get into this, I want to say this as well. The only objection they made during the trial was a 601 objection. with regard to foundation. They had made a motion in limine that he was a contingent fee witness. And you're either going to agree with me or disagree with me. You disagree with me, you strongly disagree with me, because that is not a contingent fee witness. The same as a doctor who testifies on his own behalf in a trial, and there's the same credibility issues. And it's certainly free game for you to say, doctor, you've got an interest in this thing, don't you? Shouldn't we take this into account when we're determining your credibility? Absolutely. Okay, go through that in about 2 minutes, and that's it. I can think of other examples, Judge Webb, or Judge Hawthorne, or whoever wants to listen to me, where you have the same exact situation. Say you're an engineer, and there's an engineering issue, and you're the plaintiff. Okay, you're not the defendant this time. You're the plaintiff. And you want to testify as an expert. You've got an interest in the claim. You may have the entirety of the claim. You may just have an officer. You may just an officer of the corporation.
And I think Judge Richmond's point was, let's try to set aside parties, whether they're defendant doctors, plaintiff engineers, whatever. In what other circumstance? Because that, I mean, the common law used to preclude parties from testifying because by definition they had interest. Well, that reveals
that was the point I tried to make.
Well, that rule has been rejected in every jurisdiction. So, can you help us with any examples where a non-party witness who stands to gain by the based on the outcome of the case is allowed to testify?
I'm not sure. I don't have a lot of time to think about it right now, but I can tell you this, okay? I consider him a party. I always considered him a party. Mr. Sumner, you are a party to this thing because you have an interest in this thing. They never raised the issue that he wasn't the real party in interest, but he was a party because he was a partner to the chosen action. And that's where I make my argument. That's where I make my stand.
Mr. Cristiano, was he listed on the caption of this lawsuit as a party?
No, he wasn't. I mean, if they raised the point, and by the way, they're raising all sorts of points here that they didn't raise at the trial court level. But if they raised the point that he wasn't, that Justin Case was not the true party in interest, and we object to this, or there hasn't, then probably I would have addressed it, easily would have addressed it. Just put on a caption. Which is the whole argument that I was making to Judge Pratt. But Judge Pratt came out of the middle of this. You know, he made this ruling, and I agree with Judge Richmond. He made the ruling and suggests to you that he thinks he's a contingent fee witness, but I think you go through the entire record, I don't think you see him say that once in terms of a conclusion. He just said, I'm not going to allow him to testify as an expert. Fine, I accept that. I didn't particularly agree with it. I didn't agree with everything he said. I think he's a great judge, but I didn't agree with whatever he said. But I don't think he ever said this is a contingent fee witness. And he concluded that.
Are you suggesting that?
And if you want to remand it to him and determine whether or not he was a contingent fee witness versus a person who has an interest in the chosen action, which is the claim, great.
Wouldn't that be a matter of de novo review based on the written agreement as opposed to remanding for more factual findings? I mean, the agreement.
I don't think I can argue with that. I don't think I can argue with that at all. So, but I, you know, I just, you, that is a very important distinction here, that he had an interest in the claim.
But he did not have an interest in the company. You're not saying he bought 10% of Justin Case. You're saying he bought 10%. I guess he got as consideration 10%.
Absolutely. Okay. You got it. I entered an agreement with you. And that's how he came to me, you know, together. He and Preston. And here's the agreement. And as soon as I get the agreement, I disclose it to him. Right? After the question during the deposition, I said, we're happy to give you the entirety of this agreement. And we gave it to him. And then they wanted to make a motion in limine to preclude a lot of the stuff in the agreement. But the agreement's there, okay? And I think that, you know, our contention all the way through this thing was he was not a contingent fee witness. He was a witness who had a direct interest in the chosen action, which we call a claim. And I'd be happy to go on and on about this, but I But I just strongly disagree with the notion he's a contingent fee. And they say it so many times that people start believing it.
And why would an expert witness who isn't paid hourly but is given 10% of the claim be any different than what Mr. Sumner was, putting aside the subject matter of the testimony? You would say he's not a contingent fee witness?
No. I mean, I said he is. Oh, absolutely.
So what's the difference?
The distinction is, you know, the expert witness does not have an interest in the claim.
If he has 10%, he has an interest in the claim.
So let me try. I have a contingent fee interest in a case. Okay, I do that often. Unfortunately, I do that often, much more often than I would like. Okay, I do not. But ethically, if anybody says I got an interest in the claim, they go to the ethic rules and tell me. You haven't read whatever it is, 4.3 or whatever it is, that tells you you cannot have an interest in the claim.
But you
does everybody understand that?
Yes.
Okay, that's an ethical violation. That's why I've got a contingent fee. I do not have an interest in the claim. I can't go to the client and say, I want 10% of this, or I want 20% of this business or this chosen action, because if I do, I violate it. So the ethic rules recognize this distinction.
Your time's exhausted.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to ask me after the red light's up? Or I appreciate it very much, gentlemen, and I guess I'm done. Thanks.
Just briefly, as I only have brief time anyway, but it was a contingent fee. He did not have an interest in the corporation. It's just in case. The only shareholder of the corporation is Mr. Mahoney. He was not listed in the caption as a partner. He had no right to control the litigation. All he got was a 10% recovery at the end of the day. Contrary to what Mr. Cristiano said, I believe the records show that Judge Pratt did in fact find it was a contingent fee agreement on April 13th when he denied their ability to have him as an expert witness. Because there would be no other reason to exclude him as an expert. It wasn't based on qualifications. It wasn't based on anything. Our only argument was on emotional limit, that this was a contingent fee agreement and he shouldn't be allowed to testify.
But then the question is, if it was a violation of Rule 3.4, is the appropriate sanction precluded him from testifying if it's only as a fact witness?
I believe
or is so. Cross-examination on his credibility sufficient?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I believe otherwise, well, especially combined with the fact we have no personal knowledge, I think you combine those two together. And cross-examination makes it very difficult because you're cross-examining somebody who's sort of given an imprimatur to the case, and he has a 10% interest in it. Yes, I can ask the jury about that, but he still appears. He's got a stake in the outcome, but he appears to be a third party. It's almost like an oracle. And so, yes, he hasn't. It puts me in a position, as it did, difficult to argue that he has an interest, but he doesn't have an interest, and that he's not a real witness with information. But I don't think cross-examination under those circumstances, Your Honor, is the correct remedy, because otherwise, I think you're opening Pandora's box.
Was there any evidence in the record of how badly or not Mr. Sumner needed the compensation?
No, he
could have been broke and needed it desperately, and he could have been independent, wealthy, and semi-retirement. That didn't matter.
That is correct, I believe, Your Honor, from his background. If you looked at his credentials and what they played out, it would appear that he probably was relatively well off. I don't know that for
okay, fact. But not developed?
Not developed.
Okay.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.